Good morning, Your Honor. Scott Wilcox with Byard, representing Appellant Preservation Delaware Incorporated. I plan to address the issue with regard to the Superior Court's procedural error in failing to dismiss the matter under Rule 19 and 15. Mr. Bonkowski, representing the co-appellant CCS Investors LLC, will address the issue regarding the self-created hardship matter. We'll try to split our times equally, and then we'll equally ask for 3 minutes of rebuttal.
And the clock's been set to reflect all of that. So when you see the yellow light, you're into your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, Superior Court erred in this matter by denying the City of Wilmington's motion to dismiss the action after the appellees failed to name both PDI, the property owner, and CCS, the equitable owner, in its initial pleading. It is settled law in Delaware that joinder of necessary parties to an appeal of a decision of the Board of Adjustment is governed by Superior Court Rule Civil Rule 19, and this Court's holding in Hackett versus Board of Adjustment of the City of Rehoboth Beach.
Which Hackett case are you relying on?
I'm relying on this Court's decision, the Supreme Court decision. Also noted by, I think, the Superior Court is Hackett number 2.
Right, that's the one in volume 794 of the Atlantic Reporter.
Yes, Your Honor, 794, A2D, 596. Under both Rule 19 and Hackett, the real parties in interest are considered to be indispensable and must be joined in the action. This Court went further in the Hackett decision to say that a property owner whose interests are impacted by a ruling of the Board of Adjustment is an affected party and thus is indispensable. This is because the property owner has a vested right that no other party in the litigation has. As the property owner in this case.
Now, Mr. Wilcox, if your position prevails on this point and the Superior Court is reversed on that, is that the end of the case and the variance would basically be granted because the writ was untimely?
Yes, Your Honor, it would be. The matter would be dismissed because the appellees failed to join PDI and CCS. The matter would then be sent back to the Board of Adjustment, which actually granted the variance. As the property owner in this case, as I said, no other party, not even CCS, has a larger interest or more to gain or lose in this case than PDI does. Moreover, PDI is the party that the appellees claim created the conservation easement, which serves as the central issue of the Superior Court's decision. Therefore, PDI must be an indispensable party to this action. The same principles hold true with regard to the equitable owner, CCS. As noted by the court in Sussex Medical Investors versus Delaware Health Resources Board, a party is necessary if the disposition of the appeal in the absence of that party may impair or impede that party's interest. As noted by the Superior Court in the proceedings below, CCS has a vested interest in this appeal because a reversal or modification of the Zoning Board of Adjustment's decision would affect its right to develop the property. Appellee's only response to these arguments is an attempt to unwind this Court's decision in Hackett and point to the case law that this Court specifically superseded in that decision. In addition, they point in reference to a number of procedural decisions made by the parties in the underlying litigation. When these arguments are boiled down, they provide no basis for the appellee's failure to include both PDI and CCS in the original petition.
Well, I asked you what would happen if your position prevails. The Superior Court, for reasons that we'll discuss when your colleague addresses us, said CCS had notice through their attorney, and therefore under Rule 19, they could be joined. But the record seems to reflect as to your client, they never had notice, and therefore even if this was remanded, it would be impermissible to join them now. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. There is no evidence my client was ever put on notice of the underlying appeal in the Superior Court, so that if it were determined to be an indispensable party, as I'm suggesting it should be, then Rule 15, Relation Back Doctrine, would not assist the appellees to correct their deficiency, and the statutory period would run and the case would be dismissed. The The only potential savior to the appellee's case can be found in the relation back document under Rule 15C. Appellees seek to excuse their failure to name the appellants in the original petition by invoking Rule 15C3 and claiming that they made a mistake with their failing to name the parties.
And is that based on their contention that they relied on the Superior Court forms?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. It's based upon a number of things. It's based upon their argument that they relied on the Superior Court forms, that they named CCS in the precipice but didn't name them in the complaint, and that they sent an email to CCS's counsel advising of the appeal.
But none of that would apply to your client.
None of that would apply to PDI. And with regard to CCS, the case law suggests in rule with regard to Rule 15 is that that rule is intended to protect a party who makes a true mistake concerning the identity or name of a party in the litigation. The rule does not protect those who merely choose the wrong party to sue or make a conscious decision not to name a party in the original action.
Mr. Wilcox, as I understand it, the bottom line as far as your client is concerned is that the Superior Court held that while PDI may be a necessary party, it was not an indispensable party because its interests were adequately represented by CCS.
That is correct, Your Honor.
What is your response?
My response is in this under this court's holding in Hackett, the Superior Court was wrong. PDI is a necessary party and is an indispensable party. As this court ruled, when a property owner has when a property owner's interest is impacted by the ruling.
Let's cut through that. What argument was your client prevented from making, or what argument was not made that had your client been a party would have been made?
Well,
the Superior Court.
Ultimately, we were joined into the case, so we did make all the arguments relating to us.
So basically, your client wasn't, as a practical matter, was not prejudiced, and you're relying on a rule of law, or what you claim to be a rule of law, but without any claim that the violation of that rule, if it is a rule, prejudiced your client.
Well, I disagree with you, Your Honor. By the Superior Court requiring PDI...
I'm sorry, which part do you disagree with?
Okay,
you
I'm sorry. But we weren't prejudiced. My client was not prejudiced.
How were you prejudiced?
We were prejudiced because there is a specific statute of limitations that is set for appeals of Board of Adjustments, and that's 30 days under Title 22. And by requiring PDI to include PDI in this case after that statutory period of time without going through the Rule 19 and Rule 15 analysis, the Superior Court injected PDI into a case that the appellant should have been barred from bringing against it. Essentially, it gave them more time to include PDI to the case. Ultimately, we were required to brief the issue and were able to express our position on that. So after we got past that point, no, we were not prejudiced, but we were prejudiced by requiring us to intervene in a case that was already statutorily barred.
Do you want to save your remaining time?
If I could, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, Mike Bonkowski, and pardon my throat, and with me, Wendy Stabler for Appellant CCS. I will touch briefly on the mistake issue, as Justice Holland has alluded that you may have questions for me about my client on that one. But let me approach the whole case this way, if I might. The case is fascinating because it's built on two what we believe to be fundamentally erroneous legal premises. The first is that Rule 15C3 applies where there is a legal error rather than a factual error. And the second is that a self-imposed hardship gives rise to an absolute bar to variance relief. On the mistake issue, and I would focus the Court's attention on pages 30, 31, and 38 of the motion to dismiss opinion. At page 30, the Court makes very clear that a mistake issue under Rule 15C3 is about identity. And in a number of places, the Court makes clear, he quotes a couple of cases and some treatises for the notion that a mistake as to the identity of a party is subject to relief under Rule 15C3. At page 31, the court writes, and I quote, the reasoning of these cases is that in the absence of a mistake by the plaintiff, of which the defendant sought to be added was aware, the defendant could assume that he or she was not originally joined for tactical reasons or lack of proof. And in this case, as the court itself noted below, there is no doubt that the appellant, the petitioners there, knew who CCS was. They knew who PDI was. And in fact, they litigated with them to a measure before the ZBA at the time of the hearing.
As I understand Mr. Gottes' position, it's that he intended for your client to be made a party. That was his intent all along, but his mistake was in simply not putting your client's name in the caption of the case.
I believe that is Mr. Gottes' position.
Okay. Well, why is that not a cognizable mistake?
Well, the court, thank you, Your Honor. I would reference the court's attention to paragraph 118 at page 30 of the motion to dismiss. That's a decision called Johnson versus Paul's Plastering, a Judge Quillen decision. And Judge Slights below relied on that for the proposition that you focus on the new party's understanding as to whether they were intended to be joined in determining whether an error was made and was not a, quote, deliberate strategy. And in Johnson versus Paul's Plastering, the court there expressly states, the rule does not protect a plaintiff who is fully aware of a potential defendant's identity. So whether or not Mr. Gottes' intention was to subsequently join anyone, or even to intend them to be in the case at the time, that is not a factual error subject to relief under 15C. They are out of the case. As Judge Slates wrote,
When you talk about factual error, be precise.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Tell me how that gets distinguished from a legal error and why it makes any difference at all.
Well, the notion of a factual error, as using the Johnson case, and there it was malpractice case, a personal injury case in which A.I. DuPont de Nemours was sued, but under an incomplete name. And Judge Quillen there made the point that, of course, the putative defendant knew they were the intended party because the injury occurred in their facility, and they had been subject to ongoing discussions and litigation relating to the facility. So if you know the party, but you don't put them in, whether error, legal, what I would call legal error, deliberate decision versus factual error is critical to this issue. And here there can't be any doubt. CCIS's identity was known. PDI's identity was known. Mr. Gottes concedes in different spots that one or both of these parties was meant to be in the litigation. And what's happened below is the court disregarded the fairly straightforward rule of law that it tacitly acknowledges to build a new statute of limitations, if you will, for the filing of the action, which we think is inappropriate.
Was your argument that this is a legal error? Is that why this distinction is getting made here?
The distinction is getting made because it's not an error that turns on misapprehending who CCS was. And maybe I'm not stating it very clearly. If he had sued CCS as
I think I understand.
Okay.
The argument that I presume that you are responding to is that, yes, you know, I knew who CC was. There was no mistake about that. The mistake is that, you know, as a legal matter, I should have included CCS in the caption as a party, and I didn't for various reasons.
Correct. I mean, if the point of 15C3 is for CCS's attorney or CCS to decide whether they were intended to be named or they were left out for strategic reasons, then one can only conclude that they were left out for strategic reasons as of the expiration of the 30 days. And that's our point.
You think there was no mistake?
Not as to their identity. Certainly not.
Or is your argument that if there isn't a mistake as to the identity, then it doesn't matter what the reason was for leaving the CCS out?
Perfectly correct, Your Honor. If I might turn briefly to the self-imposed hardship issue, Searles versus Darcy is the case. that in our minds makes this perfectly clear. It says that there will not be a self-imposed hardship rule in use variances. The brief is fairly, I think the briefing on this was fairly thorough. I should.
It says there won't be that, or it will not be a per se rule.
Well, it will not be a per se rule. It can always be evaluated.
So your argument, as I understand from your briefs, is Superior Court erred in saying there was a per se rule. I mean, that's your alternative argument. Your first argument is, and this was not a creation of PDI. Putting that aside, your alternative argument is that there's no per se rule in Delaware.
Correct, Your Honor. And turning to what I would call the policy arguments for just a brief second, if the court is inclined to consider whether such a per se rule should apply, it should not apply in the context of a historical property and a conservation easement. There is no notion here that the conservation easement was put in place or is trying to be eluded by PDI. They're trying to salvage this property. And Judge Slights made clear in footnote 63 that this is the only way to do it. And so in that context...
Can I interrupt for a second in terms of this being the only way to do it? It's the only way to do it and make money off of it, correct?
Well, it's the only way to do it and make it a self-sustaining venture, if you will. The money that could be derived from the ongoing total venture would be used to continue to maintain the property, which was the goal of the PDI proposal.
Okay, but if the state, for example, acquires property and then enhances it, the state is putting its own money into it for some public benefit, correct?
Certainly.
And perhaps after the park or whatever it is built, they charge admission or they charge for renting a boat on the pond or whatever it is. And isn't this the type of property and aren't the circumstances here such that the state made a decision that this property should be retained as something in the nature of an historic park-type place?
The state, in joining in the tripartite arrangement, as Mr. Gaddis describes it, does support the idea of preserving it, but ceded the preservation of it to PDI.
Okay, but I guess what I'm getting at is that is it fair to say that under the proposal that was accepted by the zoning board, the conservation easement is being preserved?
They are going to work within the confines of the conservation easement. To the extent it needs to be amended, they would pursue that. But, yes, they are working within the confines of the conservation easement, as I understand it, to be in place now, yes.
Well, then why did they need a variance? Why did they have to go before the zoning board if they were staying within the easement?
When I talk about staying within the easement, more specifically, I'm talking about the size of the property. I'm talking about some of the other issues relating to the unique nature of the neighborhood. This was going to have a commercial venture in it. The two prior variances that had been approved by the ZBA also had commercial elements to them, and that is what I understand necessitated the variance request. I'm down to 3 seconds. I guess I'll save it if I can.
Well, your effort to save it
is gone.
Used it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Justice, fellow justices. I had a short introduction prepared just basically to get the court out of the small forest and or out of the looking at the trees and stepping back and looking at the forest, but I'll try to marshal my time to avoid that. I think the court understands that what's involved here is turning an old building into an old home into an office building, making a second office building that's 100 by 100 feet, two stories high in a residential neighborhood. And the rhetoric that's being used for that is that it's necessary, a necessary evil, perhaps, that maybe they would concede that point, a necessary evil in order to preserve this building.
Well, before we get into the merits, let's talk about the motion to dismiss and the indispensable parties.
Okay, Your Honor, the order that I was going to address that was first to briefly tick off the situation with CCS. I don't think that's near as close a situation. My opponent has stressed the point that or stressed the argument that it's important to look at it from the state of awareness and the perception of the would-be defendant. And I would point out that I don't think any attorney in this day and age in the situation of Ms. Stabler, who has not favored us with an affidavit of what literally was her perception, having sent a letter in September saying let's all work together with copying public officials and getting a letter back from me saying I'll try to work with you, we're a disorganized group, but candidly we're probably going to appeal, and then sending her the appeal papers on the day that the appeal was filed and saying here are the appeal papers we filed, and then looking at my appeal papers would think, oh, we've dodged a bullet, they don't intend to serve us. At best, Ms. Stabler, who's an experienced zoning attorney, probably saw we have a gotcha here. And further evidence of that point is secondarily indicated by the fact that the city of Wilmington came in with its motion to dismiss before the sheriff served papers on the city of Wilmington. I did not send a courtesy copy to the city of Wilmington. I know that the city of Wilmington was going to be a neutral or sort of a pass-through party, might chime in as that had in some cases, but you had a split decision of the Zoning Board of Adjustment 2-1, so it wasn't gainsaid that the City of Wilmington Zoning Board was going to participate.
Well, let's pick up on that. If the City of Wilmington, we all acknowledge, is probably going to be passive, and then we really, to have a case in controversy, need someone on the other side. And your view is it would be CCS who made the application.
Right.
And the Superior Court said CCS could basically make the argument for itself and the property owner.
Right.
Let's assume hypothetically that our opinion in Hackett held that the property owner is an indispensable party. And it would seem the logic of that would be that the property owner is affected by the variance. And while an applicant, potential buyer like CCS might be interested, it's equally possible that a potential buyer would say, I'm not going to pay attorney's fees anymore. I don't want the property anymore. I'm dropping out of this. Nevertheless, the property owner like PDI would want to protect the variance it received because it recognized if it could keep the variance, its property might be more valuable. So my point is, why isn't a property owner, as Hackett seems to hold, always an indispensable party, because their property is always affected?
Well, Your Honor, I would state that in the premise of the hypothetical you just gave me is, why wouldn't the property owner want to protect the variance that it received? Your premise states, then, that it received the variance. Probably it's more accurately stated whose property received the variance. The variance here was given to CCS. It's clear on the record that the variance went to CCS.
All right. Well, now, here's my problem. In Hackett, the sentence starts out with the word clearly. So this is a direct quote from Hackett. Clearly, a property owner whose interests are impacted by a ruling of a board of adjustment is an affected party.
Okay. Well, Your Honor, in Hackett, the property owner and the applicant were one and the same. If that entity were not made a party, then there would only be a neutral whatever we should call it, the board there. And that's not the case here. I don't want to be pushed into an argument that PDI has nothing to do with this case and doesn't have an interest. Of course they do. They could do what has been done in the case of Haley versus Town of Dewey Beach, 672 Atlantic 2nd 55, where the property owner was allowed to come in.
Well, now, my question is simpler. Why isn't the property owner always, in every case, an affected party?
It is an affected party. But I don't think that makes it indispensable, Your Honor, and I'm really now really having to step a bit into an argument that I raised below, but Judge Seitz and I said, I don't want to get into a fight with the Supreme Court, and he said, certainly I do not either.
Well, now we're all here.
But now we're all, well, I don't know if he's here, but in spirit. I do not believe that the Hackett decision is obvious from my briefing, and I do not believe that Hackett is well-founded. It stands uniquely in a body of case law that has had liberalizing trends since the 1990s. It purports to draw this uniqueness, this 30-day fail-safe situation from what they refer to as the strictures, the unique strictures of statutory certiorari.
Tell us exactly in what way Hackett, you view Hackett as having been wrongly decided. That is, what part of it is wrong and why is it wrong?
The part of it that is wrong is the entire, this is an alternate argument of mine, bringing into the entire equation or the entire calculus, the entire analysis, Rules 15 and 19, when under coastal properties and all sorts of other decisions, indeed this Court's recent decision in Schweitzer, when somebody files for a statutory certiorari appeal from a Board of Adjustment, what you've got to do is meet what the statute requires. This appeal met what the statute requires, 22.328. Notice is given by the prothonotary to all parties in the proceeding below. That's done by mail. That's under Rule 72C. Now, the argument that Hackett sets up for, or the situation that Hackett sets up, is that someone opposing a variance application within 30 days has to track down the property owner. If the property owner is a foreign corporation, has to find out what state it's from. There's no paperwork that shows that. There was no paperwork below that shows that CCS investors had something called Grizz development or something.
Your argument seems to suggest that's unreasonable. If the subject matter of the zoning application is the property, all of the applications identify the property owner. Who has a greater interest in the outcome than the property owner?
No.
Because, you know, among other things, if there's a contract of sale, it's going to be contingent on what happens. But putting that aside, my question is, who has a greater interest than the property owner in a decision affecting the property?
I would yield on that the property owner has as great an interest as anyone else. I don't know if it's a hair's breadth more, but it certainly is a very great interest in the outcome. But the case law, indeed, of this court is that it is, well, I guess it's of other courts, is that it is not per se a requirement that a property owner be made a party. And they certainly can be in the case. And as I guess it was Justice Jacobs' questions posed to PDI's attorney, what argument didn't you have a chance to make?
Now, well, yeah. Tell me if you seem to acknowledge that for your position to prevail, Hackett needs to be overruled.
Hackett has to be overruled, or the court would accept the representation of that CCS was adequate. Their representation was adequate to the interests of PDI.
Okay, so, I mean, I would think that it's intuitively self-evident that the property owner here, PDI, had an interest in the subject matter of the variance.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Hackett says so. You don't disagree with that.
No, Your Honor.
So the next level of the analysis is, okay, is PDI a necessary party? Yes or no?
Yes, that is
a necessary part.
No. Yes, that's the next question.
And the court, that is Judge Seitz, held that it was. Do you agree or disagree with that? And then once we get beyond that, then we get to the level of indispensability.
Well, no, I don't agree that they are necessary parties. In the sense that their absence in the...
You didn't cross-appeal from that ruling, did you?
Pardon me?
You didn't cross-appeal from that ruling, did you? I mean, are you in a position to now dispute what Judge Slay held as far as the PDI being a necessary party?
Well, I would have had, no, I didn't cross-appeal, Your Honor. I don't know that
I'm really getting it. Isn't the real question here, and the only question, whether PDI is indispensable?
Apart from the substantive merits, yes, Your Honor.
And why is PDI not indispensable?
Because their position was aligned with CCS, and CCS was clearly in, was clearly in on time.
You're saying CCS. Yes. Adequately represented
right.
that interest.
Right. And they certainly were not strangers.
But my question earlier was from a policy point of view, the applicant, if they're not the property owner, may decide to drop out. What we're talking about on the motion to dismiss and what Justice Jacobs' question suggests about the indispensability of the property owner seems to implicate my question, which is, at the very beginning, isn't the property owner always an indispensable party for purposes of service? Then, like the board, if the property owner wants to sit on the sideline and say that the potential buyer or the applicant can make the argument for everyone, that's certainly a decision that the property owner can make. But the property owner can't make that if they're not in the case from the beginning.
Well, the direct answer to Your Honor is that I agree with what the analysis that Your Honor is walking through, going through yourself and walking me through. But all of that stems from a mistaken analogy that what these proceedings are analogous to an original proceeding. Like a lawsuit starting up, and this proceeding is a statutory appeal under a certiorari statute, and every requirement in the statute and rules was met. There is no stated requirement in 328 that says the property owner has to be named. There is no requirement that in the rule that the property owner has to be named. And there are numerous cases before and after Howard where the property owner comes in later, or where the property owner makes no objection, that the appeal just goes on and, you know, arguing with the applicant. If this court's own...
You're saying indispensability is not a static concept. It shifts or changes depending on the procedural context. And in this procedural context, which is a certiorari that fulfills the function of an appeal in a very narrow context, there's no requirement, since there is no explicit requirement that the property owner be joined, then that disposes of the issue.
I would say that, Your Honor, because if the property owner had been the applicant below, and if this paperwork were in the name of the applicant, you know, the property owner applicant, I couldn't stand here and say, well, you know, I made a mistake. But this process that's spelled out, it's actually not too dissimilar from the court's own rules. The court's own this court's appellate rule says you file a notice of appeal, and you send notice to everybody who was a party below. It doesn't say, well, you don't have to spell out a statement of claim or, you know, a long document about it.
Well, how do you suggest the statute that you rely on defines party?
Well, I don't know that it defines party. I mean, I know that it doesn't.
So you're saying that you complied with the statute?
Well, I complied with the statute. It was an application, as can be seen in all the paperwork. It was an application of CCS. CCS was referred to as the applicant. And you know, we've never been favored with a copy of whatever contract there was between CCS and PDI. But the notion that CCS would drop its appeal and leave PDI high and dry or wouldn't be in close communication with them, I don't think that's realistic. I don't think an option E would drop an appeal without allowing a property owner to come in.
Well, I know. But, you know, when we're trying to decide what would be a firm precedent, we need to anticipate that all applicants may not have the same views in the future. But my question goes back to the statute. You say you complied with the statute. In Hackett, we refer to the board as a nominal party. So I think that's pretty well accepted that the board's always a nominal party, but it seems to suggest that there's a real party in interest that should be joined.
Well, the board is a nominal party in cases where it has granted a variance. It is certainly not a nominal party in cases where it's denied a variance.
Well, here it granted a variance.
Yes. So I mean, one can't always – but Your Honor's question was that – I think was that it's always a nominal party. When it granted a variance, it is a nominal party to the party that got the variance. I mean, how can you go searching and
well,
then
– isn't that our case?
Our cake?
Didn't they grant the variance?
Yes.
Okay. So then they'd be in the nominal party status.
They'd be in a nominal party in that, and the party that granted the variance that received the variance was made a party.
Later.
No.
After the statute ran.
No, CCS.
Right. Well, I'm talking about initially. Initially, CCS wasn't in the caption. Is that right?
CCS was not in the caption.
And you only had the ability to include CCS in the caption after the Superior Court denied the motion to dismiss.
Right. I didn't change the text of what I filed whatsoever other than that caption. And that's why I got into a captioning or you pointing out that captions, when one is talking appeals, are, you know, treated by most true appellate courts in a different way. We're not, you know, that the arguments didn't change when they were captioned. And if it were not for the whole brouhaha and the certiorari supposed strictures of certiorari that lead to Hackett, I mean, in terms of providing guidance, there's a decision by the Superior Court, which Judge Sleight cited at footnote 74, Yellow Cab versus Department of Transportation, where the court said, you know, it basically distinguished Sussex Medical and Hackett and said there's no principled reason for the court to favor an inflexible approach over the long string of modern authority if an appeal is timely started and there's no prejudice allowed an amendment to bring in other people who had a stake in the proceedings. I mean, we're only here because of certiorari, and the certiorari statute is unclear. And when I filed, there's obviously a little personal edge here. I wish this hadn't happened. But in 2006, when I filed and I saved those volumes, one goes to Rule 72, one goes to 328, and you don't find Hackett and you don't find Sussex Medical. You just find Coastal Properties that says a certiorari petition that meets what the statute requires is the start and end of the discussion. Well, there's hardly time to go into the merits. But I briefly want to point out that, you know, here we have a national trust coming in with their purported national expertise. They never came up with a case that says you give special deference, you know, in policy arguments, you know, that a preservation easement should trump. There is no case in support of that. Thank you.
Your Honors, in the brief time that I have, I wanted to address just two matters which hopefully clear up the Court's questions. Justice Jacobs asked me a question about the prejudice to my client. And I think from the Court's question to Mr. Gaddis that you understood my point, and that is that PDI would be prejudiced in this case because it has an interest that's distinguishable from the equitable owner. At any time, the equitable owner could decide that this is too costly and walk away from this application. And because the variance runs with the land, the party that's stuck with that ruling is PDI and no one else. So I think the court's ruling in Hackett and the subsequent Superior Court and Chancery Court rulings with regard to a property owner's interest in this regard create a situation where, as Your Honor said, the property owner has to be at least a nominal party like the city when you're naming, when you're filing a case, and whether they actually proceed with prosecuting the appeal or not, they have to be a nominal party and be named. They weren't in this case. They were indispensable. Rule 15 doesn't save the application. It should be dismissed. With regard to Your Honor's question about the conservation easement and utilization of the conservation easement, the reason that the variance was requested by CCS and PDI was because, although the conservation easement allows the property to be developed as residential or non-res, I see my time is has elapsed. Can I finish?
The conservation
allows the property to be developed as residential or non-residential, but because the property is actually zoned as residential, the variance was required in order for CCS to continue its plan. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Bonkowski, you used up all of your time.
Might I just make a reference to the record, Your Honor?
Certainly.
To address that question that was just before you and that Justice Berger asked me about, I'd refer the court to Appendix 303, Section 2H of the conservation easement, which talks about commercial use being permissive. And I would refer the court to A134 to 138 on the presentation before the ZBA on the various uses that were considered, the testimony that was omitted, and the decisions that were made.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for your arguments. The court realizes we used up a lot of your time with our questions, but your briefs were very well done, and I think that your positions are clearly stated in the briefs, and to the extent we used your time to clarify our questions, you should all be assured it was time well spent. The court will take the matter under advisement and we'll take a brief recess.
Bye.